I miss the faces, I miss this glorious space, but I gotta tell you, the Unicanders, wow. We got a decent, when I'm not preaching elsewhere, Karen and I attend the church in Canton, New York, which I attended 50 years ago when I was in school. And we've got a decent choir, but you know, there is a difference. And certainly part of it is sitting at the piano, I hasten to add, but it's more than just them. He's got to stay at least 50 years, right, Kay? I mean, that's the expectation here. I can't remember if that was in the contract when we engaged. Sociologists tell us that we come to an understanding of whom we are partly by deciding who we aren't, a process of differentiating. Some of the categories that seem to apply are male or female, intelligent or ignorant, liberal or conservative, agnostic or believer, American or foreigner, flexible or rigid, popular or outsider, bigoted or open, tall or short, fat or thin, a success or a failure, and of course, most importantly, those who divide people into two kinds or not. I'll give you a moment. The reality, of course, is that there are some qualities about which we have no choice. Some would suggest that we actually have no choices. Between genetics and environment, we are dealt a hand of cards which we must play. We don't get to choose male or female, for instance, although we are now recognizing the validity of reassignment for people whose genitalia do not match who they perceive themselves to be. In fact, most of those criteria are not either-ors, but a matter of where we fall along continua. It's also true that some of those categories have more impact than others. Zygmunt Bauman asserts that identities are set up as dichotomies. He says, woman is the other of man, animal is the other of human, stranger is the other of native, abnormality the other of norm, deviation, the other of law-abiding, illness, the other of health, insanity, the other of reason, lay public, the other of the expert, foreigner, the other of state subject, enemy, the other of friend. Bauman asserts that social order is based on the fact that in each pair, one side is considered the standard, and the other is considered just that, the other. An inferior, that is, not like us. Simone de Beauvoir wrote that otherness is a fundamental category of human thought. Thus it is that no group ever sets itself up as the one without at once setting up the other over and against itself. The one, the standard, is considered superior, and the other, inferior. Religions, the law, media, education, the tools of culture generally reinforce those values. It's certainly clear that in our culture, males, as de Beauvoir points out, have been considered the standard, and women were secondary and therefore somewhat inferior. Thus, the book of Genesis has the male created first and the female created to serve them. Judaism and Christianity have for centuries depicted the female as inferior, the other. Women have had a circumscribed role, and it has not been the one with the most power. A woman who considered herself as equal or, heaven forbid, superior to a male had to be restrained. The language has been clear. How has Homo sapiens been referred to? Mankind. With rare exceptions, women have been denied leadership roles, have been considered intellectually inferior, and even to this day, often paid less than men for doing the same work. There have been some countries that have been well ahead of the United States in recognizing the equality of women, but conservative forces in this country continue to insist that the world would be so much better if women knew and accepted their rightful inferior place. Another us-them, majority-minority relationship, which has also been fraught with tons of superior-inferior baggage and has been very resistant to change, is the category which revolves around skin color. We know people with dark skins were brought to this country from Africa to serve as slaves, to do the work no one else wanted to do, and certainly not so cheaply. It's hard to imagine placing human beings in such an inferior role and treating them so inhumanely, and so it was decided that they, like the natives who lived here before the Europeans arrived, were not fully human. While a war was fought 150 years ago to bring an end to slavery, that war accomplished far less than many thought it should have. There were modest improvements in some parts of the country over the years, but the mindset that people of color were less human than those with pale skin has hung on for an appalling percentage of the American population. Major legal advances were finally made during the civil rights era, but that didn't put an end to the pernicious racism. The election twice of a president with African ancestors certainly has not put an end to it. On the contrary, it has elicited racist values for which they blame him. He is, in the eyes of millions of Americans, the ultimate other, an alien and a heathen. The problem of racism has certainly not diminished, but another example of us and them is very immediate today, and it also is not a new one. We do not have the luxury of addressing only one challenge at a time. This one is in part today important as a function of the current political campaigns, and it raises very real questions about the nature of who we are as Americans and the gap between our image of ourselves and the reality of our practice. We know that ours is a nation of immigrants. Even those to whom we refer as Native Americans are entitled to the designation immigrants, although their ancestors were the first human occupants to arrive here. Some of us speak proudly of our nation as a melting pot because we have done somewhat better than many more traditional societies at integrating many of the more recent arrivals. That is not to suggest that integration has been a smooth or a painless process. We have little to brag about in terms of the inclusion of the first peoples, nor obviously the descendants of slaves. But our history also includes open hostility to French and Irish Catholics, to Jews, the Chinese, Hispanics, the Japanese, and Russians. Members of these groups have been deemed as less than fully human, have been seen as lawless, as deadbeats who would be burdens on the economy, and, of course, as threats to our national security. Back in the 1850s, the nativist Know Nothing Party tried to bring about laws that would blatantly discriminate against Catholics and Jews. I was interested when I was researching the sermon to discover that the name Know Nothing was not based solely on their stupidity, the fact that they knew so little, but on the fact that, in fact, this organization was based on secret organizations which trained their members, when challenged about whether they were members, to say, like Sergeant Schultz, "I know nothing about that." Abraham Lincoln was asked about his relationship to the know-nothings, and he responded, "I am not a know-nothing, that is certain. How could I be? How could anyone who abhors the oppression of Negroes be in favor of degrading classes of white people? Our process of degenerating seems rapid. As a nation, we began by declaring all men are created equal. We now practically read it, all men are created equal except Negroes. And when the know-nothings get control," he said, "it will be all men are created equal except Negroes, foreigners, and Catholics. When it comes to this," he said, "I should prefer emigrating to some country where they make no pretense of loving liberty. To Russia, for instance, where despotism can be taken pure and without the base alloy of hypocrisy." As the Third Reich emerged, the American people, according to polls at the time, were opposed 2-1 to allowing German Jews to come to this country. Jews as the other were described as potential spies. Even a proposal to permit Jewish children to come to America was strongly opposed. Anne Frank's father, Otto, was a college friend of Nathan Strauss Jr., the head of the Federal Housing Authority, a close friend of Eleanor Roosevelt, and the son of the co-owner of Macy's. Strauss had a lot of power, and he exerted effort to help get permission for Frank's children to come here, but to no avail. Anne would now be 78 had her father been able to get her out of the Netherlands. The Jewish refugees aboard the ship St. Louis, which tried to land in Florida, were turned away, and most of them died in the concentration camps. Speaking of concentration camps, of course, one of the darkest periods in American history was when 120,000 Japanese Americans were taken from their homes and businesses and relocated in concentration camps for the crime of physically resembling the people who bombed Pearl Harbor. There was not one single case of people with Japanese heritage committing sabotage or demonstrating disloyalty to the United States, but Japanese ancestry was all it took. Citizenship was no protection. Out of ignorance, or by some nefarious design, some so-called social scientists have made up or distorted numbers to suggest that immigrants result in an elevated crime rate or have a negative impact on the economy. The actual numbers demonstrate just the opposite. Studies show that in a very short time, immigrants result in reductions in crime and in economic benefit to the communities in which they settle. This week, the mayors of New York, Paris, and London signed a joint letter telling world leaders at the UN, investing in the integration of refugees and immigrants is not only the right thing to do, it is also the smart thing to do. Refugees and other foreign-born residents bring needed skills and enhance the vitality and the growth of local economies. Their presence has long benefited our three cities. One of the major cases at hand, of course, is the question of Syrian refugees. There is, of course, the question of why it is that more than 4 million Syrians, who bear no resemblance to Skittles, I assure you, are fleeing their homes. A despotic ruler bears some of the responsibility, but millions of people live today under such rulers, and our nation even supports many of them. There was no armed resistance to the dictatorship. There was no civil war in Syria until the CIA and American money empowered the conflict that is wreaking havoc in the Syrian homeland. Robert F. Kennedy Jr. points out that Bashar Assad enraged the Gulf Stream's Sunni monarchs by endorsing a Russian-approved Islamic pipeline running from Iran's side of the gas field through Syria to the ports of Lebanon. In 2009, soon after Bashar Assad rejected the Qatar pipeline, the CIA began funding opposition groups in Syria. Gareth Porter, whose mother Avis was, I'm not sure if she was a member, but a frequent attender in this church. Gareth is an American historian, investigative journalist, author, and policy analyst. He was a Fusion guest, of course. Gary writes that it took a remarkable degree of denial and of self-deception for the Obama administration to believe that it was somehow acting to rescue the Syrian people from the bloodletting when it was doing precisely the opposite. I challenge you to explain exactly who it is we're supporting in Syria. Supposedly moderate groups to whom we have provided training and arms have turned those arms against us. What is undeniably clear is that more than 4 million people have fled in terror in Syria and don't know where to turn. Even if it could be shown that we Americans have no responsibility for the chaos, if we were the kind of people that we claim to be or formerly wanted to be, we could not turn our backs on this humanitarian crisis. 4.1 million refugees have registered with the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees. Lebanon has taken more than 1 million registered refugees and uncounted unregistered ones. Jordan has 1.4 million, Turkey has almost 2 million, a quarter of a million are in Greece or passing through. Italy has welcomed more than 100,000. Germany is anticipating 800,000. President Obama was criticized for saying that we would take 10,000 refugees. Oh, how terrible. And that was even before the terrorist attacks in Paris. After the attacks in Paris, French President Francois Hollande announced that France would accept 30,000 more Syrian refugees over the next 2 years. Not one of the Paris terrorists was from Syria. A forged Syrian passport was found, but most analysts believe that was a plant because ISIS wants us to turn refugees away. That would be a recruiting tool for them. None of the Paris terrorists was a refugee. Most were residents of France or Belgium. But none of these facts is a deterrent to politicians who these days feel free to make up facts as they would prefer them to be. Followers ignore it when the so-called facts are shown to be false. It used to be said that you have a right to your own opinion, but not your own facts. That is now a quaint artifact from the past. We're only 18 miles from the Canadian border, so we get Canadian news. Canada met its goal of welcoming 25,000 Syrian refugees by the end of February. But our Congress and 31 governors were frightened by President Obama's goal of 10,000. It is, of course, just a coincidence that all of the governors who have pledged to make Syrian refugees' lives miserable should they settle in their state are from the same political party, all but one. Shamefully, a bipartisan vote of the House of Representatives called for a delay in settlement of refugees until each one is personally certified by the director of the FBI and the head of Homeland Security. The process of certifying refugees for settlement takes generally 18 to 24 months, including repeated investigations by the UN High Commission for Refugees and by elements of our government. President Obama's goal of 10,000 was met this month. Now, some people attack the president, of course, for his failure to label the terrorists as Muslim. There are 1.6 billion, with a B, billion Muslims in the world, of whom the terrorists represent an insignificant minority, statistically. To label the terrorists as Muslim would be, no, it has been, to invite unjustified discrimination and violence against Muslim Americans. It is estimated there were about 260 hate crimes against Muslims nationwide in 2015, and the rate has increased with the rhetoric of the presidential campaign. It is a fact that most domestic terrorism in the United States is committed by Christians, who are almost never identified as such in the newspapers or on television. That frees demagogic politicians to claim that, of course, Christians never commit terrorist acts. Abortion clinics are bombed, doctors are killed by Christians who are celebrated as members of the army of God. Ann Coulter approvingly referred to the murder of abortion doctor Dr. George Tiller as a termination in the 203rd trimester. Christian David Atkinson killed 2 and wounded 7 at the Tennessee Valley UU Church because of his Christian hatred of religious liberals. Timothy McVeigh, a Christian, killed 168 and injured more than 600 when he bombed the Murrah Federal Building in Oklahoma City. And then there was the Charleston Church massacre when Christian Bill and Roof killed 9 other Christians in order to start a race war. Oh, I forgot. People who call themselves Christians don't do those things. In fact, this summer, one member of Congress insisted in a television interview that I saw that people who call themselves Christians are not real Christians if they do violent things. He was unable to comprehend his hypocrisy when the interviewer pointed out that Muslims say the very same thing about ISIS, that its followers who commit terrorist acts are not true Muslims. If the occupiers of the Federal Nature Preserve in Oregon had been Muslim or black, Do you think that the media would have continued to refer to them as protesters, as they did, or would they have been referred to as terrorists? How many of them do you think would still be alive today? I've been in the strange, and I can't remember how it came about, but I've been in the strange role of spreading the fame of the Rockford Register Star across New York State. Now, many of you will remember that over the years, I frequently dueled in print with its editors, but something has changed. I want to remind you of an editorial from the Register Star back in December. To say that we are a nation of immigrants is trite, but it's also true. Everyone who has ever lived in the USA has roots that go back to a different continent. If you visit the Immigration Museum on Ellis Island in New York Harbor, you learn quickly that each new group of immigrants was feared by people already here. The museum has hundreds of editorials, news stories, posters, and grotesque editorial cartoons depicting the latest groups coming here as being dangerous, hideous, uncouth, and even subhuman. All were a threat to the American way of life, to some. Now we're experiencing another wave of anti-immigration panic, as some people worry that refugees from the Syrian civil war might be secret terrorists. Some have spread the designation to all Muslim people. However, as senior editor Chuck Sweeney points out in his column today, back in December, becoming a refugee isn't easy. There are exhausting background checks. They must wait from 2 to 3 years to actually get to another country. Locally, the editor said, Catholic Charities handles all refugees who come to Rockford. This organization processes about 300 people each year and hasn't had a terrorist over the 27 years that they've been bringing people here, many from war zones. Indeed, they are eager to be good Americans. Within 5 years of being here, 50% have bought homes, and nearly all families have someone working within 90 days of arriving. The editors urged, let's step back and take a deep breath and ask ourselves, do we want to become like nations we despise? Stopping refugees from war-torn Syria from coming to the U.S. won't solve anything. They come here for the same reasons our ancestors did. They're seeking a better, more prosperous life in the USA. Yes, we must screen out people who would be a danger to our well-being, but we don't need to post a No Syrians sign. We could be preventing the next Mitch Daniels or Jerry Seinfeld or Steve Jobs from coming here. All three were Syrian Americans. I know that your governor is not a hero for many of you. I'm not particularly fond of New York State's governor, but this time he got it right. When the 31 governors turned their backs on the refugees, Governor Cuomo's comment was, we have to protect Americans and not lose our soul as Americans in the process, right? The day America says, close the gates, build the wall, then I say, take down the Statue of Liberty, because you've gone to another place. And read Emma Lazarus and the poem on the Statue of Liberty, to which Spitty referred. Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to be free. Once you say, we're out of business, that's no longer true. So I won't let them win by conceding defeat of the American dream. As Governor Cuomo urged, do consider the words of Emma Lazarus in her poem, The New Colossus. Not like the brazen giant of Greek fame with conquering limbs astride from land to land, here at our sea-washed sunset gates shall stand a mighty woman with a torch whose flame is the imprisoned lightning and her name, Mother of Exile. From her beacon hand glows worldwide welcome. Her mild eyes command the air-bridged harbor that twin cities frame. Keep, ancient lands, your storied pomp, cries she, with silent lips. Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free, the wretched refuse of your teeming shore. Send these, the homeless, tempest-tossed, with to me. I lift my lamp beside the golden door. The immigrant songwriter Irving Berlin set these words to music, and I brought with me someone to share them. This is not the end of the sermon. This is only the end of the introduction to the sermon.
Scared you.
Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free, the wretched refuse of your teeming shore. Send these, the homeless tempest-tossed, to beside the golden door. Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free, the wretched refuse of your teeming shore.
My maternal ancestors came to America on the Mayflower, second voyage, so they didn't see the Statue of Liberty. My father's parents came here from Romania in the early 1900s, so when their ships entered New York Harbor, they did see and were moved by seeing Mother Liberty and what she stands for. There are the huddled masses of which Lazarus wrote, yearning to breathe free. The problem is, there are also huddled masses in America for whom the issue today is less breathing free and more breathing securely. Fearmongers are hard at work in America today. They want to divide us for political gain. They're taking a page from the fascist textbook. They know that fear is a powerful emotion. Fear can make people stupid. Fear can lead people to set aside their principles, to, as one candidate, you may recall, has predicted or promised, to do things we never would have thought of, like creating a data bank of the others, or even to make them wear or carry identification, as the Nazis did the Jews. Fear makes people seek a leader who purports to be strong, one who will make us great again. It worked in Germany. Will it work in America? There is evidence that it could, unless there is resistance, unless enough of us stand up and say, hell no. In spite of what the hate mongers tell us, terrorists do not have the goal of depopulating of America, killing us all. They want to kill enough people to make us afraid, to get us to do stupid things, which then end up helping them recruit followers and gain power that can be used to force us out of their region so they can finally live their lives in peace. There's a Muslim, watch out, be afraid, be very afraid. FDR said it. All we have to fear is fear itself. Compassion is the enemy of fear. Love is the enemy of fear. People who love have hope because they are focused on how people are alike, how we share a common humanity with the others. Ben Franklin warned us, those who desire to give up freedom in order to gain security will not have, nor do they deserve, either one. Now, my Bible may be different than some. Maybe it's because I'm a UU, but I can't find the place where the prophets of Jesus said, it's okay to turn away the widows and orphans and strangers and to build higher walls. What I read is, the Lord doth execute the judgment of the fatherless and widow, and loveth the stranger, in giving him food and raiment. Love ye therefore the stranger, for ye were strangers in the land of Egypt. Or this, let brotherly love continue. Be not afraid to entertain strangers, for thereby some have entertained angels unawares. Or come ye blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungered, and ye gave me meat. I was thirsty, and ye gave me drink. I was a stranger, and ye took me in. Naked, and ye clothed me. I was sick, and ye visited me. I was in prison, and ye came unto me. Then shall the righteous answer him, saying, Lord, when did we see thee as hungered and feed thee, or thirsty and gave thee drink? When saw we thee a stranger and took thee in, or naked and clothed thee? When did we see thee sick or in prison and came unto thee? And the king shall answer and say unto them, verily I say unto you, inasmuch as you have done it unto the least of these my brethren, you have done it unto me. Or consider the principles that unite us as Unitarian Universalists, which include a commitment to the inherent worth and dignity of every person, justice, equity, and compassion in human relations, and the goal of world community with peace, liberty, and justice for all. I want to tell you that I think what we are facing is nothing less than a challenge to the core of our covenant as people of faith, our nation as a place of liberty, as a haven for the oppressed. Will we turn away in fear and allow the haters to win? We are better than that. We must be better than that. We must offer resistance to the propaganda urging us to turn our backs on human misery. We have much to live up to, and we dare not turn away, or what will we become? Now more than ever, we need the courage to resist, to rise above fear and hate, to risk welcoming the stranger, and to challenge those who threaten our welcoming by standing together on the side of love. And we might even sing about our commitment to doing